The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Book Nook coming up for you this morning. I'm Vic McCunis, and today I'll be interviewing a man who was on the program a few years ago. He returns to talk about another one of his bands. He's the musician Peter Hook. He was the bassist for the group Joy Division. We had him on for his Joy Division book a few years ago, and now he's written a tell-all book about his band New Order. The book is called Substance: Inside New Order. And Peter Hook doesn't pull any punches in this one. Stay tuned. It's all coming up following National Public Radio News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Peter Hook. He's got another book out. It's called Substance: Inside New Order. He joins us by telephone from New York City. Hello, Peter.
Hello, how are you, mate?
Excellent, Peter.
Yeah, we can't go on meeting like this, can we?
Yeah, you know, I had you on for your book about Joy Division, and I guess we probably have two or three listeners out there who have never heard of Joy Division or New Order. And before we talk about your New Order book, I guess maybe we should tell them, who was Joy Division?
Joy Division was a punk group formed after the Sex Pistols punk explosion in 1977. They went on to be a post-punk group where the music matured a little, shall we say, and became a little deeper. As opposed to, I mean, if you had to explain punk music to someone, that's a tough one, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Our
singer, sadly, committed suicide in 1980, just when we were on the cusp of becoming very successful. We formed a new group, completely cut off ties with the old group, ignored the music, and the new group was called New Order. They went on to be even more successful than Joy Division. Although Joy Division are very very successful musically these days, I must admit, with the younger generation. New Order became a huge international success, completely a product of the 80s, beginning in May 1980 and finishing in 1990, where they played the England World Cup song, for anyone who's interested in football. And then over the next decade, split up, got back together again. Pretty normal behavior for groups.
Hmm. And some listeners will recall that for many years I hosted a music program here on WYSO, and occasionally I would play music by Joy Division. And some of you are probably wondering what Joy Division sounded like. So we're going to bring you a little musical treat this morning and play you a track that they recorded back in 1979, featuring my guest Peter Hook on the bass. This is called Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Hard and ambitions are low, and
Music from Joy Division on the Book Nook, recorded back in 1979. That was Love Will Tear Us Apart, featuring the late Ian Curtis on the vocal. And that was Bernard Sumner on the guitar. And my guest today, Peter Hook, playing the bass. And the first time we had you on the show was for that book, Unknown Pleasures Inside Joy Division. And wow, this new one, Substance Inside New Order, you really take us inside. And the guitarist for Joy Division and for New Order was a guy named Bernard Sumner. And this is very much a story of your relationship with him, isn't it?
Yeah, so I suppose to short circuit the whole thing, yeah, it's definitely about the two main players. Musically and mentally. So, yes, it is our story, correct. We met at the age of 11 in secondary school in England, and we've been together in one way or another ever since, and probably will be entwined, whether we like it or not, until the day we die.
Hmm. I saw that he put out a book last year, and out of loyalty to you, Peter, I did not read it.
Mate, please feel free to read it. It will not take you long.
No?
No, I mean, he, you know, it's always quite an odd thing, and I'm sure he's had the same problem with me doing a book. You know, reading about yourself and reading someone else's version of it is quite interesting, but it's probably very frustrating. The thing about Bernard's book is that I did feel that he did himself a great disservice in that he sort of devoted 100 pages to his growing up, which I found quite interesting because obviously, you know, from the age of 11, I grew up with him. He devoted 100 pages to Joy Division, which were, again, quite interesting because it was nice to hear from his perspective, you know, how he viewed the band and Ian Curtis, the singer. And then he devoted 100 pages to the story of New Order, and 69 of them were calling me a bastard.
Hmm.
So I was actually very flattered by that attention, but feel that he did himself a great disservice in that he never talked about his talent, which is big. He has a very big musical talent. And, you know, to survive as I did, coming from one doomed group to another, I thought it would have been very interesting to hear him describe how he made his music and his words. But yeah, he seemed to be more intent on having a go at me, shall we say, than explaining how he did it. So the book, from what I can gather, most people feel quite unsatisfied with it. And I must admit that I did hold it up as a template for how not to do my book.
Mm. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Peter Hook. We're talking about his book, Substance Inside New Order. And The Book Nook will continue right after this. Peter Hook joins us. His book is Substance Inside New Order. And you did have another book, which really relates to this story about New Order. Your other book, Hacienda, How Not to Run a Club. This is very much a story of the Hacienda Club and also of your hometown of Manchester. You guys are very much products of Manchester. What is it about Manchester?
Now, if I knew that, mate, I'd be sat on my yacht in the Bahamas, wouldn't I? Manchester has been a constant, huge musical force all around the world since the late 70s. And at certain points in the 80s and 90s, you had more successful bands in Manchester than any other city in the world. I think I can say that with complete safety of non-contradiction. So as to why that is, I have no idea, because Manchester isn't such a bad place that we'd all be desperate to leave it. You know, it was a bit grim in the late 70s, but over the 80s and 90s it's become a charming, huge city, and is regularly thought to be the second biggest city in England, even though that accolade actually does go to Birmingham. So we steal its crown. We have two hugely famous football teams, hugely successful, Manchester United and Manchester City. So, yeah, we managed to leave a mark and have left a mark on the world that is quite enviable, I must say. Now, I had no idea. The only reason I can give you is that the people are very special.
This story is very much about the power struggles within your band. And when we look back at Joy Division, Ian Curtis, your late vocalist, was very much the leader of the band. But then when he was gone, you guys were all kind of equals in New Order, and you really didn't even know who the singer was going to be. And once Bernard became the singer, then things started to shift ever so slightly, didn't they? What is it about singers?
It culminated, sadly, our manager in Joy Division and New Order, who was called Robert Gretton, was a hell of a character. Typically ebullient, very bullish manager. And he was very much in charge. Once Ian left, he really took on the mantle of pulling us all together, seeing us through some very difficult times, in many ways taking advantage of those difficult times in the true rock and roll manager fashion, which happens many times with groups. But my interpretation of it is that once he had a nervous breakdown, cocaine-induced nervous breakdown, in 1985, it was then that the balance of power shifted. And Bernard seemed to be struggling to become the leader. And the way that he got his position was by, in my opinion, being very negative and difficult. You know, a true diva, we would say, a rock and roll diva. And, yeah, I mean, it was strange because we struggled together for quite a few years, but then when the music changed, that was when, you know, I felt the group was starting to lose its uniqueness, its appeal, and we weren't the group that we started out. I mean, you know, it's a very, people can read both books. You know, there's an opinion in his book, and there's an opinion in my book. The drummer, Stephen Morris, is doing a book at the moment.
Oh.
So all we have to wait for is for Gillian Morris's book about her involvement in New Order. And then, you know, the jury, the audience can decide, can't they?
Yeah, I guess so. This is a big, thick book, and you have so many precise memories. You take us inside every recording session, inside every song, inside every appearance, every live show. How did you keep track of all this? Did you keep a diary?
Well, I mean, I'm very lucky in that because New Order are so revered and they have so many fanatical fans, there's a lot of websites that detail all the gigs and all the set lists and things like that. And I have many, many tapes that I did myself of our performances. So I did keep a lot. I mean, bass players tend in groups to be the one that collects. Another prime example of it is Bill Wyman with the Rolling Stones, who used to collect everything to do with the group. I'm the same. And, yeah, all the history was there. My friend did say to me, you know, at one time, I used to tell these stories for free at dinner parties and gatherings. And what I've done now basically is written them all down so that I can sell them to people. It's got quite an interesting take on it. But, you know, the stories were there, the history was there, the records are obviously there. I am a great fan myself. I love reading books like this. lists and, you know, discographies, videographies, da-di-da. And it was my intention and my ambition was to do one for Joy Division and New Order that brought all the information together. The book, when I finished it, before I delivered it to the publishers, was 300,000 words.
Oh, my.
I had to edit it down by a third to get them to publish it. So I'm hoping that, you know, my version of the complete history one day will be done as an e-book so that people can have all the rest of the anecdotes and the things that are missing from the published book. You know, they simply couldn't or wouldn't publish such a huge book.
It is massive.
It would have been a third again.
Even in the print version, it is massive. And it's funny you mentioned Bill Wyman. We had him on the show probably 15 years ago, and I agree with you about him. And I was reminded, reading your book, about the way that the Stones supposedly were treating their founding member, Brian Jones, near the end of their association, because you had this very collaborative process of writing the music and recording the music, and you were kind of getting written out of the music, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, Bernard's interest, along with Stephen Morris, Gillian didn't really have much to say from the start to the beginning of the start to the end of the group, really, was very much about going electronic. And I was struggling not only to keep my place, but also to bring us back to rock, which was my love. You know, inadvertently, we created a whole new style of music, which was dance rock, which really is emulated by every band in the known world, you know, today. So we were unique in that respect, and we were the first to do it. So, yeah, I mean, you were fighting for your life. Yeah, it was very sad, actually. You know, you start a group all going forward, all wishing and hoping for the same thing. You're very, very close. Your hopes, ambitions, and your lives are completely entwined. And then to be sort of excluded is heartbreaking. You know, I mean, I had a lot of fans. Rob Gretton was a fan of what I was doing, our manager. Mm-hmm. Tony Wilson was a great fan of what I was doing. So it wasn't as if I was on my own, but it was a struggle. And there were a couple of songs that I lost, only a couple in the whole repertoire. But towards the end, we changed. You know, I mean, it's like any relationship. Over the years, you're very lucky. That's why so few marriages last. It's because people change as they get older. Mm. You know, it's a simple fact of life. And we did change. We had different ideas for the music, Bernard and I, and different ideas for the group, different ideas of loyalty, different ideas of generosity, everything like that. And we just grew apart. That was the truth. And my struggle with him as the singer stroke leader was that he was a very, very bad leader.
Mm.
He seemed to divide and make everybody miserable, rather than enjoying this wonderful gift that God had given us of being a successful band for 30-odd years. And that culminated in a tour of South America in 2007 when I simply could not tolerate his behavior any longer and knew that the group that I started had gone. And the ethics and the ideals that we had when we began had also gone. And it was awful. It was awful to be in a normal group whose leader seemed intent on making everybody completely miserable with regard to the success that we'd worked so hard to get.
Mm.
And that was it. The band split up. And then, and I don't think it's any coincidence, after the biggest economic crisis this world has ever known in 2008, the band decided to get back together again. But this time they decided to get back together again without me. They did a ruthless limited company takeover where they, in my opinion, stole the trademark, took it, and left behind very, very poor financial repercussions for me. And I'm still fighting that legally to this day. They deprived me of 25% of New Order. And behind my back while I was away in China. It's a terrible story, you know, and 10 years later, here I am, still fighting. We were actually in court this morning, weirdly. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a hell of a story, a hell of a battle, quite unique in many, many respects. But I'm very proud of it all. You know, I don't regret anything. I didn't cause this fracas that we've ended up saddled with here for the last 10 years. You know, all I did was split the group up. We were all free to go our own ways. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story. I mean, there's obviously another book in it.
I'll say. The book is Substance Inside New Order. Peter Hook wrote it. He joins us on the telephone today. Peter was the longtime bassist with New Order. And let's look back at those early days when you were writing songs together. Tell us what the process was like back then when you were truly collaborating. What was the vibe? What did it feel like?
There was a joy de vivre with we only used to write by playing together. And even if you were doing an electronic song, the electronic song would be quite a bare backing, but you would play over the top of it and refine those ideas. It was still very live, very collaborative, very rewarding, actually. It got much more difficult once you incorporated technology, because technology is difficult. It's unpredictable. It's uncontrollable. And the thing is that even computers will show you how hard it can be to operate on a medium that's contained in one little box, you know. And I felt that as we got more electronic, we were downplaying the talents of the group. You know, in my opinion, it was all about the group. It was all to make sure that everybody in the group was featured, that we acted and, you know, were happy to be a group. Whereas Bernard's idea of the group was all about the song, you know, and who he had to trample on to get that song finished was little or no consequence to him. If you weren't in his, you know, his ideals or his line of fire, then you were just ejected, unceremoniously dumped. And I just thought that was a very strange way to work and alien to my personality.
You have a list. You have a lot of lists in this book, and one of them is your 10 best. You have the 10 best New Order songs in your opinion, and your favorite one is Thieves Like Us. Why is that your favorite?
For Thieves Like Us, I felt it was always overshadowed by Blue Monday. It was the single we released after Blue Monday. Mm-hmm. Blue Monday, quite rightly, became the biggest 12-inch in the world, and still is, to my knowledge. It's still the biggest selling 12-inch record of all time. It's never been surpassed. But I never felt that it was a great song. I think Thieves Like Us is a wonderful, wonderful love song. It was inspired on my part by Hot Chocolate, the group, a song called Emma, which I've always loved even as a child. And it was just much more evocative, much more emotional, much more song-like, if you like, than Blue Monday. Blue Monday was like a bit of a sonic assault. Whereas I thought Thieves Like Us was a much better crafted song. I mean, that, don't forget, that list changes. You know, every minute I'll have another new, another favorite song.
Yeah, you in the book you talk about running into Errol Brown from Hot Chocolate and admitting that you'd taken some riffs. The late Errol Brown,
and he didn't care at all.
Yeah, he didn't.
You know, I mean, what a character. Because I remember that the first Hot Chocolate LP is a fantastic LP, actually. Uh-huh. And the bass player is a fantastic bass player. It's called Cicero Park. And it really is worth seeking out as a great example of 70s disco pop record. Wonderfully produced. So, yeah, he was a local boy as well. He spent a lot of time in Salford, where I'm from, in Lancashire in England. And he was someone to look up to. He was really unusual in that once he'd written enough songs to sustain his lifestyle, he stopped. And he had no interest in writing anymore, because he always used to say to you, "Why would I, dear boy? Well, I've written enough." You know, and it's quite an unusual, because most musicians talk about being driven and it being a vocation. It was actually quite refreshing in a way, to find someone who, you know, told the truth about how he felt.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm talking to Peter Hook about his book, Substance Inside New Order. And we've been talking about the music And the fact that a song by New Order is still the top-selling 12-inch single of all time. It's called Blue Monday. It came out back in 1983, and for those of you who were listening to us a few minutes ago, you heard the first band, Joy Division. We're going to play a track for you now from New Order, and we're going to play that track. This is called Blue Monday on WISO. And for those of you just tuning in, this is the Book Nook, believe it or not, but we're playing you some music from performances by our featured author and artist today, Peter Hook. His book is Substance, Inside New Order, and that cut you just heard was recorded back in 1983, and it became the top-selling 12-inch single of all time. The song is called Blue Monday by New Order. And featured Peter Hook on the bass. And we'll continue with the Book Nook right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. My guest on the program today is Peter Hook. His book is Substance, Inside New Order. Peter, I had the pleasure of seeing you during what you describe as the golden years of New Order on your 1983 tour. I saw you at First Avenue in Minneapolis.
Oh, wow.
And you just smoked. And you have a funny little anecdote when you talk about that tour where you say at the end that the owner of the club invited you over to his studio and you just went, what? Who is this perv? Remember? You remember that part?
I remember it very well. The selling point that the guy was trying to get us over to the owner's pad was that it was all purple.
Uh-huh.
And he was a great lover of music. And, yeah, you know, a typical Manc attitude was tell the old purple. Of course, it was Prince. You know, I suppose it's one of those occasions, isn't it, you know, when you look back and think. A great friend of mine, actually, you know, Dave D from Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch?
No.
Yeah, he was telling me that he was my next-door neighbor and also a very close friend of mine. I miss him dearly. It's very sad, you know. He died of cancer about 5-6 years ago. Uh-huh. He always used to tell me a story of when the Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch toured with Jimi Hendrix. And Jimi Hendrix was smashing his guitars up every night.
Uh-huh.
And his roadie would put them and leave them hanging about all over the place. And he said one night he got so fed up that he collected all these broken guitars and went and threw them in the canal.
Yeah.
And he always says to me, oh, my God, I can't believe. So I suppose it's one of those lessons that you learn, isn't it?
Yeah.
With life on the road. And I can just imagine somebody turning around and going, where's all Jimmy's broken guitars? And he'd thrown them in the canal stroke river at the gig outside.
Now you did stuff with Bernie's old guitars, and you have a great Jimi Hendrix anecdote in this book. You talk about watching him at the Monterey Pop Festival where he famously lit his guitar on fire, and you decided you were going to try it.
Yeah, it was one of our gigs in Reading. We weren't getting on. And I thought, as a fitting epitaph of this last gig that we were doing, that I would burn my guitar. You know, the symbolism didn't escape me. And I thought to myself, should I use petrol? I thought, Jimi Hendrix must have used petrol. And then I asked a friend of mine, and he said, no. He said, if you watch the film, he's using lighter fluid. And I went, oh, right. So I went out, bought 4 tins of lighter fluid. I'm on stage there in Reading. Everyone watching me. I dump the guitar on the floor, spray the lighter fluid. Now, the interesting thing about lighter fluid is that it's the vapor that burns.
Uh-huh.
And not the fluid. It was very windy on stage in Reading, and I was throwing match after match on this lighter fluid, and it just would not burn. And my another great friend of mine, Kevin Cummings, the photographer, has got it all down in black and white. And I suppose it's one of those things is that along with your dodgy haircuts, you have to be very careful being in a group, because every, you know, mistake you make is chronicled.
Mm.
So, yeah, a salutary lesson to us all.
Peter, you talk about, it's almost heartbreaking to read. You talk about all the hard work you did, all the music you recorded, all the tours you went on, and you'd come back, and for years and years and years, you didn't have squat. None of you had any money. This is heartbreaking to read.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's the thing is that, you know, in music, especially when people look at a successful group, the first thing they think of is that they're obviously loaded. They're millionaires. You know, people still think I'm a bloody millionaire now, and it's so far from the truth, it's absolutely ridiculous. I, like everybody else, have to go out and work to earn a living, to support my family, to keep my lifestyle. There's no way on earth, even at the ripe old age of 60, that I could contemplate giving up my job, you know. And it is a bit of a cliche that people think as soon as you have your hit, you're minted, you're rolling in it, you know, and, and this is so far from the truth. And the honest truth is that groups and group members are treated by the music industry deplorably. They really are.
Mm.
They're taken advantage of, they're ripped off, they're kept in the dark, they're overcharged, They're overpriced. Everybody is making a fortune apart from them. And in many ways, I thought it was about time that somebody told the truth. Because I've read many great biographies, you know, and the one thing they always leave out as if it's sordid and can't be spoken about is how much they earned for it, money. They never talk about money. And it really pisses me off because I'm reading it and thinking, I wonder how much the Stones got for that record. I wonder how much that contract was worth, you know. And they never answer the most obvious question. And I thought I owed a duty to everybody just to put the record straight in a way and just inform people, you know, about how much not only does it cost to be in a group, but how much you earn. Some of the figures are fantastic. Some are ridiculous, you know, but it's worth it. And it's very, very interesting, you know.
It's all here. The book is Substance, Inside New Order. Peter Cook wrote it. He joins us on the program today. And speaking of substances, you're very candid about your drug abuse and your drinking. I was astounded by how much cocaine you went through.
Well, I'm not proud of it, let me put it that way. But again, I did feel that if I was telling a story, then I would be doing something remiss if I didn't tell the story of my own life. My abusive marriage, which I received a lot of stick for in England for revealing the details of it, my drug addiction, my alcohol addiction, my rehabilitation. You can't, you know, tell stories about everybody else and not tell stories about yourself. I think that people would have seen through that for what it is immediately. And I would have, reading a book that would have been one-sided, would have been, you know, you'd be pissed off with the teller. So I wanted to tell the whole story, warts and all, and put the record straight, yeah. You know, I mean, those were big moments in my life, and I would have been doing a very, very great disservice to myself if I'd have left them out. There would have been no excuse for leaving them out.
Peter, I don't want our listeners to misinterpret what you just said about your abusive marriage. I'd like to point out that this woman you were married to, she was a famous comedian, TV star, and she was abusing you.
Yes, she was, yes. I mean, it's a very strange thing when you have male spousal abuse. You know, it's a very difficult thing for a man to write about. But what I was hoping by exposing it was being able to be in a position where you could help people, men and women, that are suffering from the same thing, to show that there is help and you can rebuild yourself and you can, you know, not only help yourself, but you can get help in the same way that I did with my alcohol addiction, my cocaine addiction. Being a battered husband was highly embarrassing. And, you know, I agonized over whether to tell it, but I'm hoping, and it's been proved to be the case, actually, that by telling the story, it's inspired and given other people an impetus and an inspiration to put right, shall we say, their wrongs and help them, you know, overcome it.
It's very powerful, and this is an incredible book, Peter. And I just have one
Thank
more
you.
Question. What's your life like today, Peter Hook?
My life's great. I'm with my wife of 20 years. I have a wonderful 18-year-old daughter who's absolutely beautiful. I have my son who's very successful. He plays with me in the group. He's also a bass player with the Smashing Pumpkins, which I'm doubly proud of. Mm-hmm. My other beautiful daughter lives in Manchester. She seems happy. She's single. So, yeah, life's pretty good. I've got, you know, I'm standing up for what I believe in and for what I think is right. I'm having a huge battle with the other members of the group, which shows no signs of abating, which is very sad. But, you know, you go through all these things in life. And what I've learned is that, you know, to be successful in life, you have to be happy with yourself. And I've done, you know, I've acted badly and I've suffered. And now I'm sober. I've been sober for 12 years. And when I get up in the morning, I thank God for every day. And I look in the mirror and I smile. And I think, wow, you know, I was lucky. I managed to lose myself, and I managed to find myself. And you know what? I actually like myself.
Well, Peter, thank you for writing the music memoir of 2017 and for talking to us about it today.
You're welcome, mate. It was an absolute pleasure. And, you know, my only regret with this, mate, is that I've written three books and none of them have a particularly happy ending. My ambition is to do a fourth that has a happy ending.
We'll watch for that one.
Okay, mate. Thank you very much. Thanks for your call.
My pleasure. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Peter Hook. And that's it for The Book Nook for this morning, except we have a little extra time, so we're going to give you another little musical bonus. You heard me talking to Peter about seeing his band New Order back in 1983 at First Avenue in Minneapolis. They put on a heck of a show, and Peter referred to that in his book as the golden years of New Order, and he talks about all the golden years and some rather tarnished years as well in his band book, Substance, Inside New Order. And when I say band book, I'm referring to his band New Order, not the fact that the book should be banned. And they did put on great shows. And back in 1987, they performed at Glastonbury, the big festival in England. And they put out an album, BBC Radio did, recorded live in concert, New Order. And we're going to close out the program today with that track recorded back in 1987 called Temptation from New Order. You're listening to WYSO.
Descriptive. you before.